Hey, we all know how tough it can be to find the time to sit down and make progress on a book you've been trying to read. Tell me about it. I've got two kids. But what if I told you it's possible to absorb 10 nonfiction books in just an afternoon? Well, that's exactly what today's sponsor, Blinkist.com/ROF, allows you to do. Blinkist is the only app that takes popular nonfiction books, distills them down into summaries that you can read or listen to in about 15 minutes. You'll still get the most important takeaways and the crucial information from each book, but it'll be so in a concise, efficient package that you can consume in one sitting or at the gym or on your way to work or in between podcasts. Now look, I know I want to make time for reading as many books as I can, but there's only so many hours in the week. So why not go ahead and get the most valuable insights from nonfiction books that you otherwise wouldn't have had time for? They have everything from politics, history, philosophy, to economics, business, psychology, and personal development. You can try Blinkist totally free and get access to their library of thousands of condensed nonfiction books by going to Blinkist.com/ROF. That's Blinkist, BLINKIST.com/ROF. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, journalist Kira Lerner will join us to discuss the powerful role confusion plays in American elections. Jeff Hauser from the Revolving Door Project will join us to explain why we must prosecute Donald Trump to the full extent of the law. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will help me run down all the news that made headlines this week. And labor journalist and former high school teacher Eric Blanc will be here to discuss why teachers have walked out of their classrooms in Los Angeles this week. Just a reminder, have you signed up for the Ring of Fire Radio podcast? Well, you can help support this show by going to ROFpodcast.com. You can sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, become a member and help keep us on the air. It's the best way to support this show. That's ROFpodcast.com. Here to run down the biggest stories of the past week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her from her blog, Hullabaloo, Digby. So, Heather, of course, the big story this week is that Donald Trump served fast food to the to a football team in the White House, or at least that's what you would think if you watched enough cable news this week. But the reality is that we are now in the longest shutdown in the history, a government shutdown in the history of the United States. It is an illegal one based upon labor law that people are supposed to get paid for the work that they do, and you know, having passed the deadline for the first paycheck that government workers were set to receive. We have, now a considerable violation of statute. I wish that was relevant in this day and age. It's not. But the latest, I guess, this week was Nancy Pelosi said, challenged Donald Trump, don't give a State of the Union address because, you know, the government shut down, which is, I think, from a political standpoint, a pretty smart move. The Republicans are already being blamed for this. Donald Trump is already being blamed for this, largely in part because Donald Trump said, blame me for this. It's going to be my fault. but this is it's an interesting period of time right now because there are literally hundreds of thousands of Americans who are directly suffering from this. Probably millions at this point, not just federal workers, but people who were anticipating, people who work in shelters to help battered women in around the country, people who are anticipating maybe they won't get their SNAP payments I mean, around the country, there's a lot of problems that are starting to build up, but yet it hasn't quite permeated, it seems, the sort of the consciousness of the American public.
Well, that's true. It's you know, 800,000 people are not being paid. A bunch of them are being forced to work anyway, as you point out, which is illegal and immoral and awful. But there, you know, it's not just, you know, there are a lot of people who depend on those federal workers. I mean, I think we all know how the economy works. It's one of the reasons, you know, the whole sort of underpinning of the Keynesian economics, which says that, you know, the demand, it's a ripple effect, right? I mean, if you have people who are out of work, as would happen in a recession, I mean, this is as if 800,000 people were all laid off on the same day in America. And all the people, and then there are a bunch of contractors who aren't guaranteed work anyway, and so they were expecting it because they work, but they are not on the payroll, so those people aren't being counted. And then there are all the people, like, who runs the luncheonette down the street from the, you know, from the federal office, where people normally come in and buy lunch every day. Those people are also not making any money. There are, you know, there's a ripple effect throughout the economy at a time when, you know, things were a little dicey anyway. I mean, we saw the stock market crash, not that that means anything, but it did, it dropped substantially before the end of the year last year. Yeah, there's a lot of weakness and weirdness. You've got people like the farmers out in the Midwest who were already reeling from the trade war that Trump caused for no apparent reason, or whatever his reasons were sort of random and abstract, and not thought through properly. And, you know, there's all those people as well. So there's a, you know, this is just suffering that's starting to happen. And I think, I read a thing last week where one of the, I think it was Senator Kennedy from Louisiana was flying on Air Force One, and he said there was absolutely no way that Trump was going to do anything but the wall. And people were telling reporters, Republicans, high-level members of the administration and Republican officials, that the only way that this was going to end would be if the airports shut down, and there are millions of Americans who are unable to travel, and then maybe the president would listen. I mean, and talk about cowardly, right? I mean, these are Republicans. They could override the president's veto. They could do this. They could do it tomorrow.
That's right.
They could do it. You know, they could have done it.
And we talked about this.
In fact, we're planning to.
I think we talked about this last week.
We did.
You know, that Mitch McConnell was And we're starting to hear some, you know, from the, you know, the some grumbling with the Republicans. We've been hearing it for a while. If you live in a state which has a significant number of farmers, you're a little bit concerned because the farmers aren't going to necessarily get their payments. They're not going to get the opportunity to get loans. If you live in a state where there is a large segment of your population who rely on things like food stamps and other programs, you're going to start to worry about it. And basically, if you're running for re-election as a Republican senator, you're going to be worried about it unless you're Mitch McConnell. Because Mitch McConnell, and we mentioned this last week, he was a villain in 2016 for the Republican Party. He is very worried about a primary. And so he is very afraid of going against Donald Trump. And on some level, like, you know, it is amazing that you could see such a divergence in the caucus where Mitch McConnell is deathly afraid of going against Donald Trump. And there's a half a dozen other Republicans who are running in states, you know, even states that are red states, who are deathly afraid of not ending this government shutdown. I think it was last Friday, Stacey Abrams was on Capitol Hill talking to folks like Chuck Schumer about a potential run for the Senate. And I don't know how real that those conversations were, but the message was pretty clear to the two Republican senators from Georgia. And that is, you better get on the ball, because Georgia's turning a blue state. And in 2 years, you're going to be in big trouble, because this could really resonate. And the shutdown of the planes, I think, is fascinating, and there's a fascinating dynamic around that. And I want to talk more about that. But the interesting thing is that that's where it has the government shutdown, oddly enough, which is a national phenomenon. plane travel is one of the few things that is shared nationally, right? The interesting thing about the government shutdown in terms of the way that it impacts Americans is that it impacts them on a local level. The local program that deals with domestic abuse, that is understaffed. People get cut mm-hmm. from that. But it is all it all comes in the form of grants and localized. Plane travel or something like the FDA, frankly, or the food inspections, those are the only things that hit nationally in some way. And it'll be interesting to see. But let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit more about this. And Nancy Pelosi's calls that Trump mentioned it during the State of the Union address and where we go from here. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I'm talking to the great Digby, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Turn your magic on. Let me see it say. Everything you want to dream away. We are legends every day. That's what she told.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, in the last segment, we were talking about the government shutdown and this interesting dynamic that as a function of how many literally hundreds of thousands of workers are being forced to work without pay and others who are off, and that, you know, these federal workers are dispersed throughout the country. It's very difficult to for the media, I think, to create a narrative because there is no specific, singular, shared experience until, as you mentioned, it was reported that Republicans on Air Force One We're coming out and saying that, Donald Trump is not going to react to this unless there's some type of shutdown in the airports, because that is one of the few. Well, there's two elements to that. One is it's a shared experience that happens nationally, right? I mean, simultaneously, this is going to affect people in Chicago, in L.A., in New York, in Miami, in Dallas, in Atlanta, Omaha. I mean, this is going to affect everybody simultaneously across the country. And frankly, it's also going to impact wealthier people more than people, of less means. And they debate, that's the way our society works. They have more access to the media in many respects. Then the question becomes is, do you think that we're going to see some type of labor action? Because, this is an opportunity for folks in the TSA or for federal aviation air traffic controllers to exercise some labor muscle.
Well, it may be. This is going on long enough now. I mean, it's the longest in history. And it buys, quite a bit now, too. I think it's like, I don't know, it must be 24, 25 days, something like that, by the time people are listening here. It is a, this is a very long period, shutdown. And, people can't live without their paychecks. I mean, I think average Americans, even people who have money, normally need their paychecks. I mean, this is just not something that I think that's kind of a bottom line understanding across all, except for maybe the top 1%, people like Donald Trump, who says, oh, I can relate. And actually, somebody, I think it was Britt Hume from Fox News said, don't people understand that he doesn't get a paycheck? He has given up his own paycheck. It's like, are you kidding me? But in any case, I don't know what obviously something like that is likely out of necessity. These people can't work and not be paid. They can't not be paid. I mean, that's just the way it is. So, there's going to have to be some kind of labor action, I think. And we're already seeing it, of course, on the part of TSA. A lot of the TSA people are calling in sick, and some people are saying that they're out getting temp work. because they need to get some cash. So, you know, they can't go to the job that isn't paying. They've got to go to one that is. And, you know, so that's actually happening. And, you know, if the air traffic, well, the air traffic controllers got, there's be a very interesting sort of reaction, I'm sure, from the right wing on that. But the airline pilots have already registered their concerns about this. You know, this is not a system you want to put this kind of stress on. Let's just put it that way. From TSA to airline pilots to air traffic controllers, these are people you want to have a predictable workplace where everything is, you know, is running as smoothly as possible. Because if something goes wrong at any point in that system, you know, airline safety is definitely threatened and people are unsafe. And, you know, here's Trump out there saying over and over again, my main mission is to keep America safe. Well, I mean, this is basically not keeping America safe. It's making everything more dangerous for all of us, and not just with airlines, with everything from food inspections to drug inspections to everything, you know, highways, everything that the federal government does and the ancillary services that go with it are impacted by this. So at some point or another, you know, people are going to start to feel it. And I think people are already kind of going, whoa, wait a minute. And Pelosi canceling the State of the Union or disinviting the president, which is her prerogative as speaker, is absolutely the right thing to do. You can't stage a big pageant like that in the middle of this and have I would be an obscenity, I think, as the government is shut down and the president's standing before Congress and they're all, you know, all the Republicans are clapping like a bunch of trade seals that what a great president he is. I mean, it's outrageous. Of course she had to cancel it.
I mean, it's interesting. Like, I wonder, does she have the ability to actually cancel it? I mean, or is this really more of a way of basically saying, look, I'm going to put you in a box, and that box is either going to be you're going to listen to my suggestion to not do the State of the Union or to just submit it in writing, or you're going to do the State of the Union, and I've just basically framed the entire speech as one which is going to happen during the course of a government shutdown. Because I think the idea that there's some type of state of emergency is a non-starter at this point, right? Like, I mean, this has been going on.
The shutdown is the emergency, right?
Well, I mean, that's indeed, indeed. And the reality is that, look, you know, you mentioned food inspections. Some of the most, sensitive food inspections, I think they have restarted with inspectors who, again, not making any money. But the reality is more people die by, you know, probably a multiple of two or three or four or five and never mind getting seriously ill. More people die from lack of, you know, from food safety issues every year by, you know, like I say, multiple factors than die because of crime that is committed by so-called undocumented immigrants. I mean, you know, so never mind, you know, in terms of drugs and in terms of like getting social services and whatnot, this is the crisis and he has created it. I want to talk a little bit more about this. We're going to have to do it in the next hour. If you will join me, Digby, I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back, and Digby will join me in hour two of the show. Just ahead, Jeff Hauser explains why we must prosecute Donald Trump to the full extent of the law. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
I've been down and I'm wondering why these little black clouds keep walking around.
Hey, folks, you're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. This show is on commercial and non-commercial radio, as well as a podcast that we do on a weekly basis. But frankly, there is no revenue in radio anymore. We go on radio because we want to reach as many people as possible with some of the best analysis, independent analysis we can offer, and reporting that is done by reporters online for stories that may not make it very often into the mainstream media, or at the very least, into anything other than print publication. So we need your help, because it is folks like you who decide to become members for just a couple of bucks a week that support what we do here. So if you think it's important, if you enjoy listening to the show, and if you want more of it, commercial free, plus access to our archives of over a decade's worth of programs, head over to rofpodcast.com. Sign up for a membership. You can do a yearly membership for a significant discount. Or frankly, for just a couple bucks a week, you can become a monthly member. Head over to rofpodcast.com. Appreciate your support, and we really appreciate your listening. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Our next guest has written that in order for America and Americans to feel like this country is fair, we need to start prosecuting powerful people when they commit crimes, including current and past presidents. Here to explain, the executive director of the Revolving Door Project, Jeff Hauser. So, Jeff, there are two components to your argument about prosecuting Donald Trump to the full extent of the law. And I would imagine this also goes for anyone else who is found to have breached the law in the course of operating in the Trump administration. The two major components are just simply what is best for democracy. And also what is there's a political argument in terms of those people who oppose Republicans and what they tend to do when they're in office. But before we get to that, let's just sort of quickly dispense with the notion. I mean, has Donald Trump done things that ultimately he will be subject to prosecution for? I mean, you know, putting aside for a moment the question as to whether a sitting president can be indicted, at one point he will not be president. And what do you anticipate he will be prosecutable for?
At a minimum, there are some mundane issues, but legally significant, such as the ways he violated tax law of both New York State and the federal government with respect to running the Trump Foundation as basically just a way to take in tax money and avoid taxes on it. He pretty clearly violated a series of campaign finance laws with the payouts to women that he did in conjunction with Michael Cohen. He's essentially an unindicted co-conspirator in cases to which Michael Cohen has pled guilty. So this is like a much better argument than you normally get to make about somebody when there hasn't been a prosecution, because most people are not unindicted co-conspirators or individual number one, as in his technical case. But I think that he has engaged in money laundering. The Financial Crimes Enforcement Network has previously fined him on a civil basis for money laundering at the Trump Casino. At the Trump casinos in Atlantic City. I think there's probably going to be evidence that he did money laundering in conjunction with Russian oligarchs, even separate from the Robert Mueller investigation, and any number of tax issues that were developed by the New York Times massive investigation into tax crimes by Trump and his siblings, some of which the statute of limitations has let out, which is basically a get-out-of-jail-free card if prosecutors don't find crimes quickly enough for individuals. So he may well be clear of most of those criminal obligations, but not necessarily all of them.
Okay, so and we don't even have to really raise Robert Mueller's name, largely speaking, when we talk about those things that he's prosecutable for today. We could maybe, reconvene in 6 months and have another list of things. And I would imagine It's also possible that once he's out of office that then people start digging around in what went on during this administration. There may be another host of things. But you have outlined a fairly sufficient dance card of prosecutable offenses. So let's talk about, and I want to circle back at one point to the question of how's he been able to get away with this. But before we get there, the idea that he has gotten away with this stuff up to this point is, in some respects, the foundation for your argument that from a perspective of democracy and maintaining some stability within our society, it is essential that we prosecute Donald Trump. Why?
So we need, in order to be a country that has ruled under a shared law, a law that applies to all of us, it has to be the case that if people break the law, they are treated the same way. Obviously, that's not often been the case in American history. It's been an aspiration. So, you know, in apartheid South, even after the Civil War ended formal slavery, obviously it would be insane to say that America had full equality under the law in 1950. It very much did not. But the fact that there was an aspiration and a sense that the country was moving toward more equality under the law meant that we were getting better and people had some faith in an American dream and in the idea that America might become a country in which we were all treated under law the same. And the tendency, while imperfect, was to get better through probably the 1970s, maybe into the 1980s. People can quibble about the exact time at which things started to go sideways. But I would argue that in recent decades, America has become less equal under the law. Your odds of going to jail if you commit a crime as a powerful person have gone down precipitously, even as mass incarceration is an enormous blight on our country. And I think that that tears at the fabric of our country. It tears at the notion that we're all in this together. If you think about the rhetoric of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a lot of it was about making America live up to its aspirations, you know, referencing the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution as having set forth ideals that the country maybe hadn't lived up to but could move toward. And I think that the ability to have these sort of shared aspirations, these shared ideals, these shared principles as something that we could move towards has been on the decline, and we're potentially reaching sort of a breaking point at which people are thoroughly cynical. And I think it's very hard to be a nation if we're relentlessly cynical. We need some faith, and I think that's why we need to really stop this trend toward powerful people getting away with whatever they can.
And we should say that there's plenty of data to support your thesis that, you know, we are living in a time where there is an incredible amount of disillusion with all the institutions that the major institutions of our society, I mean, across the board, and questioning our, like I say, every institution and the leaders therein. And so to what extent do you think, as we look back on these last, I don't know, 4 or 5 decades, you say it's difficult to put a time on it, but I mean, it does fall around a time where the President of the United States committed a series of crimes and never, as the President, right? As the President, committed crimes as the President and was never held to account by the time Richard Nixon died. There was a major reformation project and, he was hailed as a great statesman in some quarters. I mean, what are the implications of that? And then we'll take a break and follow that trajectory through the years, because there's almost like we saw that story play out multiple times over the next couple of decades.
Yeah, in 1974, Gerald Ford, who had not even been elected as vice president but ascended after Richard Nixon's vice president, was forced to resign in disgrace. And then Nixon was forced to resign in disgrace and basically one step ahead of the impeachment crowd right after him. And Ford pardoned Nixon, and at the time it was very unpopular because people had expectations that the president would be held accountable. But relatively quickly, Ford got credit from the establishment for having helped us move beyond let's look forward, let's not look to the past. And that's part of why Gerald Ford almost came from way behind to win the 1976 election, is that the kind of original sin of the Ford administration, which was that he pardoned an obvious criminal in Richard Nixon, was sort of forgiven. So within a couple of years, you started seeing this trend develop. And then you had the Iran-Contra affair, in which Ronald Reagan and most of the senior members of his foreign policy team committed pretty blatant crimes. And yet Oliver North got to testify, and because he looked good in a uniform, basically people were fawning over Oliver North, and there were all sorts of impediments put in place for Lawrence Walsh, the former Republican federal judge who was pursuing Reagan and his team of criminals. And then that led to George H.W. Bush, in conjunction with his then Attorney General, Bill Barr, who you might recall is the person being nominated to be Trump's get-out-of-jail-free card right now. Bush and Barr pardoned a series of people, including Caspar Weinberger, to basically make sure that Bush and the other senior members of the Reagan administration were not held to account for Iran-Contra. And it's basically just been downhill ever since.
All right, Jeff, let's take a break there, because we have another more recent example of this type of get-out-of-free-jail cardism, if you will, in the last decade. But we will talk about that on the other side. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back. Back on Ring of Fire Radio, I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking with the executive director of the Revolving Door Project, Jeff Hauser, about his piece in the HuffPost, Prosecute Donald Trump to the Full Extent of the Law. So, Jeff, in the last segment, we were talking about the last 40, 45 years or so of American history, where we have example after example of, and maybe just a coincidence, maybe not, of Republican presidents engaging in obvious lawbreaking and managing through either pardoning their own underlings or having their underlings pardon them to avoid any type of accountability. And, you know, you had commented on Ford's pardoning of Richard Nixon that was very unpopular at the time. But within a certain period of time, the establishment of this country, the media establishment, even the political establishment, praised him for getting the country past that. But I think the point that you have made in your piece, and we can go up and include Barack Obama's response to the Bush administration in a moment. But the point in your piece is that, in fact, we haven't gotten past it. We buried it in some way. And and what happened is that we, rather than actually dealing with accounting for lawbreaking by the elite, essentially, of our country, we submerged it and it turned into a cancer. But before we get to that, and that cancer, of course, is this disillusion with our institutions in this country. But just remind us about Barack Obama's, I guess, turn the pageism, because you had a very good point in your piece about Obama's perspective on justice, that it would seem somehow unique to look back on crimes that have been committed.
Yeah, I mean, Barack Obama basically said that, look, we're in a national crisis, and if we were to look back at the illegal response to 9/11 of the Bush administration, waterboarding, Abu Ghraib, memos from the Office of Legal Counsel of the Justice Department that basically argued that torture is fine regardless of international and domestic law. I think that if you look at that kind of perspective, that it is problematic to raise unpleasantness from the past if we're trying to be united as a country, I think that gets it absolutely wrong. What unites us as a country is our democracy. The rule of law is the product of our democracy because laws are generated by our democracy. And the notion that some people are above the law by virtue of the fact that they're too important to prosecute is a very dangerous concept, just as too big to fail is a dangerous concept for banks, another entity that where prosecutions were turned down by the Obama administration. So in general, the Obama approach was that the more powerful you are, the more problematic it would be to try to hold you to account because you might fight back and it would be controversial and it would be unpleasant.
You know, I'm not a huge fan of Saving Private Ryan, but when you look at the cavalcade of members of the Trump administration, including Donald Trump himself on some level, who should have been prosecuted at one point, right, during the decade beforehand, and how they end up there, it reminds me of that scene where they let the German soldier go and he came back and shot somebody, essentially, right? I mean, that's what we have with Steve Mnuchin. Steve Mnuchin should be in jail or should have been maybe coming out of jail before he becomes the Treasury Secretary. And I would imagine there's a multitude of people like this. Not the least of which is our CIA director as well. You mentioned torture. But okay, so you've made the case, it seems to me, that from the perspective of a healthy democracy, that you need to deal with these problems rather than just getting past and turning the page. But also speak to if that's not enough to sell people on this idea, which I think it should be. But there's also at least if you're a part of the party that does not commit these type of crimes, a political reason to make sure that people are held to account.
Yeah, I mean, basically, there's an entire generation of Republicans which have aided and abetted Trump's travesty of an administration. The serial lawbreaking of the Trump administration would not be possible if the Republican Congress of the past 2 years and the continuing to be Republican Senate right now were not aiding and abetting the Trump administration. The system is not working because the Constitution's framers thought that there'd be a separation of powers and that Congress would guard against executive branch overreach. And that's just not going on. And so if you were to continue to emphasize in the future, even after Trump is out of office, the many manifold sins of the Trump administration, be they the idiosyncratic ties to Russia and the emoluments clause violations and the like, or the more mundane but, you know, no less awful corruption and empowerment of the worst bankers and pharmaceutical companies and other corporate bad actors, if you were to tie those sins to the rest of the Republican Party that was okay with them in office, I think you could permanently tar and brand a generation of Republicans for that action. But if you stop talking about Trump, if you try to just focus on the future and don't look backward to the Trump years, you'll emulate what happened in 2009 and 2010 when Obama refused to talk about George W. Bush. He didn't actually mention George W. Bush by name in the first 14 or 15 months of his presidency. And that reflected just a general aversion to being seen as partisan by bringing up the Bush legacy. But the economy was tanking all around Obama, and that wasn't Obama's fault. That was the legacy of the Bush years. And his unwillingness to criticize Bush and tie the events of 2009 and 2010 to its source in the Bush years allowed Bush's congressional allies who had made the George W. Bush presidency possible from 2001 to 2008 to reclaim power as quickly as 2011 after the disastrous for the Democratic Party 2010 midterms. So I think what we've seen is that if you don't brand and tarnish an entire party based off of a disastrous president, you miss an enormous opportunity, and that's the opposite of the lesson FDR took. I mean, Democrats during FDR's years, and actually even later than after FDR was dead, they brought up Herbert Hoover any time they could. For a generation, you would invoke Herbert Hoover to talk about why Republicans couldn't be trusted to run an economy that would work for ordinary working people. And I think that the Democratic Party should learn from the success of FDR, which, you know, produced a political party that was capable of winning control of Congress for 58 out of 62
exactly.
years.
Well, Jeff, it's an excellent piece, and it is advice hopefully a new generation of Democrats will take to remind people of the failures of the Republican Party that aided and abetted Donald Trump, both in what his criminal activities may or may not have been in office, but just in terms of from a policy standpoint. Jeff Hauser, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Jeff Hauser is the executive director of the Revolving Door Project at the Center for Economic Policy and Research. The Revolving Door Project scrutinizes executive branch personnel in order to ensure that political appointees focus on serving the public interest. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from this past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget ROFpodcast.com to sign up to become a member of our podcast.